This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn covered China for the New York Times for 5 years. They fell in love with the country when they moved there in 1988. They had their hearts broken the next year in Tiananmen Square as they watched China go mad. They won Pulitzer Prizes for their coverage of the massacre. Of course, as they watched China, the Chinese authorities watched them. Even when Kristof and Wu Dunn went jogging, five guys tailed them. Kristof and Wu Dunn got married shortly before moving to China. Now they've collaborated on a new book called China Wakes, The Struggle for the Soul of a Rising Power. Cheryl is Chinese-American. I asked if she thought that looking Chinese gave her more access to certain people and stories.
I certainly did. I was very lucky in some respects, but the experience was not always very happy. I remember one time when I was looking into the problem of sexual harassment of the status of women in China, and I was at a party one night, and a cabinet minister came over to me and asked me to dance. He must have thought that I was a local secretary or something, and we got out to the dance floor, and all of a sudden he tried to force himself upon me. I was shocked, but it gave me enormous insight into the problems of women. And it's one thing to read about and to intellectualize the inequality of the sexes there, but it's another thing to be crushed in the arms of a cabinet minister.
Did you tell him who you were?
I did, and then all of a sudden he froze. And he didn't ask me for the second dance.
It really worked out. I think it really worked out very well sometimes to have a combination of a Chinese American and a Caucasian American, because, for example, I could go to Beijing University and talk to students there. They knew I wasn't a government spy. That occasionally was a help. While Cheryl, 90% of the time, it was a help for her to have her natural camouflage. You know, for these government goons who were tailing us, Cheryl could go in one end of a subway and come out the other, and they'd lose her in between. They could never tail her very far. And that was a tremendous help, especially in the years after Tiananmen, when people were, you know, terribly worried about getting in trouble.
Nick, I know you write that you were often scolded about the stories you were writing by the foreign ministry liaison. And in 1992, the foreign ministry summoned you for regular struggle sessions. What are the struggle sessions?
Well, they would be upset about one article that I'd written or another, or occasionally about Cheryl's articles. And I mean, I always wondered what they expected me to do at that point, you know, divorce her?
Discipline her, maybe.
I suppose. And they would... I mean, what they were fundamentally doing was that they had been scolded by some other branch of the government, and they wanted to put something in the file showing that the foreign ministry had denounced me. They were really protecting themselves.
So what's a struggle session like?
Well, I get called in, usually on about 20 minutes' notice, to go to the foreign ministry immediately, and then I'm greeted very sternly by our liaison, who has a personality like a fingernail on a chalkboard, and then a note taker. And we sit in a big conference room, and the foreign ministry fellow says, you know, Mr. Kristof, you have hurt the feelings of the Chinese people with your slanderous attack on the Chinese government, and we will not stand up for this. And then typically I would say, well, if I've made a mistake, you know, we'd love to correct it in the New York Times. We actually have corrections in the Times, unlike People's Daily, and, you know, tell me what the mistake was. And then they would sort of fidget and read it over again, and, you know, then we'd offer to print a letter to the editor. And at this point, their note taker would typically be giggling, insufficient ideological training.
So were you ever punished?
No, they came pretty close, I think, a couple of times to kicking us out of the country. But in the end, they didn't. And, you know, there really wasn't much that they could do to punish us. Our fear wasn't so much getting kicked out. It was really that they would punish our Chinese friends. And that was the worst burden that we faced.
Nicholas, you write in the book that China is confusing because it marks the intersection of the two most important trends of the late 20th century, the collapse of communism and the rise of East Asia as an independent powerhouse. Which direction do you think China is heading in now, a more last bastion of communism direction or the new economic powerhouse?
Well, we have every reason, I suppose, to think that it's the last bastion of communism, you know, between being tailed, between seeing kids killed at Tiananmen Square, between having very good friends who are still in prison today. And yet, we think that, you know, the most important thing happening in China and probably in the world today in general is this economic explosion in China that's just transforming the lives of 1.2 billion people.
I mean, China is the most populous nation in the world. I mean, every one in every five people on this planet is a Chinese person. It's just unthinkable what the possibilities are if China becomes the largest economy, which it might be, in according to current trajectories, by sometime the next century.
You write that if and when the Communist Party collapses, corruption will be one of the major reasons why. You saw corruption on the rise during your years in China.
Yeah, we welcome obviously the rise of a market economy and the collapse of any kind of sort of Maoist ideals, but a market is rising in kind of strange ways sometimes in China. I mean, for example, there's one village called Haotou in Guangdong province, and it decided it wanted to find its niche in the market economy. So the people in the village just began kidnapping young women in other villages, forcing them back to their village and forcing them to work in brothels in that town. I mean, that little village was the sort of ran the brothel industry in the area. And they decided this was the market economy. This is fair game.
You know, corruption in China used to be a traffic cop taking 10 yuan, the equivalent of $1 or $2, instead of issuing a parking ticket. Now it's the cops in cahoots with the crooks running brothels and smuggling rings that are even taking human beings from the southern part of China to New York City on boats like the Golden Venture. The best way to think of it, it's mafia style. And one way to think about it is look at if you have a car stolen in Philadelphia or in New York, you might want to take a trip to southern China and look at the used car lots there, because you might find your car still with the Philadelphia or New York license plates on it. And the way it got there, just like thousands of other cars that are stolen each year from the U.S., is that they're smuggled over to China with the complicity of the authorities, of the customs officials and the army. And they're registered to new Chinese owners with the help of the local police. It's all open.
Did you drive while you were there?
Yes, we did.
What did you drive?
We drove a Beijing Jeep.
With scratches on both sides, courtesy of the State Security Service. They wanted to be able to identify our car more easily, so they scratched both sides.
Cheryl, when you first got to China, you were at first very impressed with the number of working women and the independence that women seem to have, and then you found yourself getting less impressed with the strides that women seem to have changed. What did you notice the longer you were there?
I realized that for thousands of years, Chinese women had been thought of as no more than just walking wombs. And, for instance, my grandmother had her feet bound and wobbled for the rest of her life whenever she walked. After 15 years of reform, I had initially thought that the status of women would have improved dramatically. But in many ways, I found that to be the opposite. I found that with the rise of the market, it came the rise of sinister industries you might have the cotton market, you might have a market or a trade in copper or toys, but there's also a trade in women. There are established networks of businessmen and even women who go to peasant villages and they recruit women there with the promise of greater jobs and higher pay, and they transport them to faraway places where they don't know the local dialect. If you don't know the local dialect in place, you basically can't communicate. And they sell these women to uneducated peasants. And if anyone tries to escape, if a woman tries to escape, she's usually beaten up. I know in one case, a terrible situation where the woman tried to escape and the peasant basically blinded her. He gouged out her eyes.
Cheryl, you mentioned that your grandmother, who was born in China but then came to America, that she had her feet bound when she was young. Did you see her feet when you were growing up?
My mother, she was on my mother's side, and unfortunately my grandmother died before I was born.
What did your mother tell you about what your grandmother's feet looked like?
It was always a very sensitive topic in the home. They didn't really want to talk about it, but my mother was saying that she always remembered her mother's feet as just square blocks, square flat blocks, and that she always walked very funny and she couldn't walk for very long periods of time.
So what did you grow up thinking about how women had been treated in China?
Well, When I was growing up in the U.S., China was a remote land to me. And although I'd grown up with stories of the motherland, I'd never really focused on the treatment of women. It wasn't until I actually got to China and saw that there's such an enduring tradition of the worthlessness of women. And that is resurging now with the rise of the economy. This is a very surprising thing. Of course, there is greater opportunity for women in China now, and I don't want to diminish that. But there are fewer controls now, and Mao Zemin basically used his political will to tell China that women should hold up half the sky. But now that's receding.
One of the saddest things is the way technology is affecting the status of women. You know, the bit of modern equipment that I think is changing China the most in the 1990s isn't the car or, you know, the computer. It's the ultrasound machine. And in this kind of country that has a 4,000-year-old tradition of favoring boys and where peasants are typically limited to just one or maybe two kids each, then they're using ultrasound machines. And when a woman is pregnant, she goes to this ultrasound operator and finds out the sex of the baby. If it's a girl, then the woman gets an abortion. And, you know, as a result, you've got 1.7 million girls missing each year.
Have there been recent changes in the population policy that have been responsible for increasing the amount of female infanticide?
It's hard to say whether or not they've caused more female infanticide, but there's certainly been a change in the policy, a tremendous crackdown. And it's ironic. It's a story, in effect, that I think we were proudest of breaking and the one that we were sort of most ashamed of breaking. It was a big crackdown launched in 1991. It led to the forced sterilization of millions of women. Probably nowhere in the world was there any government policy that affected so many people in such an intimate way. And, Cheryl and I broke the story 2 years later. It took us 2 years to notice that you'd had this incredible change of policy affecting, 900 million Chinese peasants. And I think that underscores the way everybody is out of touch with the Chinese countryside, and unfortunately, including us.
How many children does the government allow a family to have now in China?
The official policy is one, and then in some areas it's two. And depending upon the remoteness of the area, they allow three and four. It varies from area to area.
And how is it enforced?
Coercively, unfortunately.
So I guess the forced sterilizations you're referring to was part of the enforcement policy.
Right. Or you can get your home knocked down if you have a child that you're not supposed to, for example. But typically, the basic way in which it's enforced is not so much through fines or even knocking your home down, but family planning authorities go to every village, typically twice a year in the fall and in the spring, and they round up all the women who've had their quota of babies. And then, herd them off to a family planning clinic to be either sterilized or to have an IUD inserted.
And sometimes, because of the very complex quota system, the results are just horrific. We saw a document, a confidential document, that described the case of a woman who was, in her third term of pregnancy, and the authorities, because they wanted to have a certain number of births in 1992 rather than 1993. They wanted her to give birth in 1992. So when she was less than 7 months pregnant, they dragged her off to the local clinic and forced her to have the baby. Well, the baby was born dead, and she was crippled for life.
My guests are Cheryl Wu-Dun and Nicholas Kristof. They covered China for 5 years for the New York Times. Now they've written a new book called China Wakes. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with New York Times reporters Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu-Dun. Their new book is called China Wakes. You won Pulitzer Prizes for your coverage of Tiananmen Square. Nicholas, you write that what happened in Tiananmen Square just immediately changed your emotions about that country.
I think that it's hard not to be standing on Tiananmen Square that night, watching as it's lit by the glow of these armored personnel carriers, and seeing these troops fire on you and on the kids around you and not be enormously changed. But one way, I think, in which that really did change me perhaps the most is that we tend in this country to be often very patronizing about peasants and about whether uneducated people can can support some kind of a more democratic system. And clearly there are problems in a place that doesn't have a lot of education to have a working democracy. But, you know, that night when they were firing on us, I was cowering. My notebook was stained with sweat from fear, and the students were cowering in fear. But when there was a lull in the firing, it was these peasants who were rickshaw drivers, barefoot, uneducated people, probably illiterate. And they got on their rickshaws and they drove out toward the troops. And they loaded up the bodies of the dead and the wounded and put them back on the rickshaws and then drove back to safety, to the hospitals, the tears streaming down their cheeks, their legs pumping away at the rickshaws. And, you know, I mean, here we are in a country in the U.S. where, you know, a lot of PhDs don't want to risk bad weather to go out and vote. And so to see these uneducated peasants, rickshaw drivers, risking their lives and losing their lives to promote democracy was something that I will never, never forget.
Now that the student dissidents have been arrested or driven underground, what do you think has replaced them as the primary dissident voice in China?
Right now, there isn't much of a dissident voice in China, and I think that the reason is that people are afraid, you know, that we make the mistake in this country of thinking that Chinese protest when they're most outraged, and they don't. They protest when they think they can get away with it. And it's pretty clear now that any Chinese, if he, you know, takes to the streets, that he's going to get arrested. The most prominent dissident, Wei Jingsheng, just got tossed back into the same prisons in which he'd already spent 15 years. And so I think that what is going to happen is we're going to have to wait until there is, you know, some easing of the repression and when people think, for whatever constellation of factors, that they can get away with it. And then I think we're going to see more voices of protest.
You said that you think the industrial labor force is a possible rival to the power of the Communist Party.
Absolutely.
What's happening there? Are you talking about people organizing?
Well, you know, I mean, Marx wasn't entirely wrong. I mean, the industrial labor force does have tremendous potential power, and the Chinese communist leaders read their Marx. One problem with the past democracy movements is these were led by eggheads, by students, by intellectuals. There are some labor leaders who are trying to organize these workers, and it's tremendously combustible material. I mean, these are workers who are angry at corruption, angry at inflation, angry at the risk of layoffs. So far, the government has tried very, very hard to crack these underground movements. And this leader I mentioned, Wei Jingsheng, the dissident, one reason he was put back in prison is that he's an extraordinarily articulate and charismatic leader who perhaps could galvanize, at some point, the labor movement.
What do you think the United States should be doing in terms of its trade and human rights policies?
I think that the policy, the usage of the most favored nation status, was very effective when they first used it a few years ago. And the Chinese were extremely afraid that the status was going to be revoked and it would hurt trade between the two countries. It would hurt specifically Chinese exports to the U.S., which was earning China a lot of money. And so they released political prisoners. They did collapse in the face of this kind of threat. But now, I think the tool is ineffective. It was like a trigger. We were holding a gun to China's head, but we weren't pulling the trigger. The Chinese knew we wouldn't. So we need to move on to different tools.
You were both in China from 88 to 93. How did you know it was time to leave?
It was partly because we were beginning to worry so much about getting our friends in trouble. I mean, during our last year, a number of foreign reporters had gotten Chinese reporters and Chinese friends sent to long prison terms. And, you know, you can last for 5 years without that happening, but sometime you're going to mess up.
It's a crazy way to live a life, you know. If you want to get in touch with a Chinese friend, then first of all, you can't write down that person's name and telephone number anywhere in your house. Cheryl and I couldn't have a conversation about any of these friends in our home or in our office because it was bugged. We'd have to go off to another telephone somewhere to make a telephone call to these people and set up an appointment. and we'd have to drive out and somehow lose the tails who were following us. And the whole time we'd meet with these people, especially if they were in some kind of sensitive position, you know, we'd be just terrified that, you know, our luck was going to run out, that they would figure out who we were talking to and arrest that person and destroy not only that person, but perhaps their family as well.
What would you do in China in your spare time?
We spent almost all of our time with our Chinese friends and you know, having dinners with them, going off to things, taking our baby and playing with them. But as reporters, the whole atmosphere sometimes becomes laced with mistrust. One of our closest friends in the post-Tiananmen period was a fellow we call in the book Hong Jun. It's a pseudonym, but you know, we really trusted this guy. And then one day another friend came to us and said, you should know that, you know, this guy is a spy. And he's asking if you and Cheryl are writing a book, and are you writing it on the hard drive of your computer or on floppies? And, you know, we were crushed, and we went through and we established through other friends that he had been a spy all along, and that he'd been attached to a reformist work unit, but that had just been a cover. So state security could send him off to talk to people. And we couldn't confront Hong Jun. We couldn't tell him what we knew, because then he would figure out who had told us. And so we went through this charade of a relationship for the next few years where we would continue to have lunch with him. But, you know, we had to still pretend that he was a close friend. And then he asked us for a letter of recommendation to go to the U.S.
What did you do?
Well, I couldn't say no, because he would have been suspicious. And so I wrote a very lukewarm letter. And then Cheryl and I agonized over this. Next time I was in Hong Kong and I knew I was on a phone line that wasn't tapped, I called up the head of the program and said, look, this guy is a very, very nice man, and he's a spy. Well, and so Hong Jun and I continued to get together, and, you know, I like this guy, and he helped us. But we knew, as we'd sit there over lunch, that he had betrayed us, that he was trying to find out our sources. And we also knew that we had ruined his chances of going to the U.S. There was layers and layers of treachery there.
Yeah, it was like the typical Washington lunch, huh?
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn are co-authors of the new book, China Wakes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.